We should go back to telegraphs. Remember telegraphs?
Yeah. Remember Morse code?
Oh, yeah. Remember Morse code? We should go back to smoke signals. Remember smoke signals?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pigeons.
Remember that?
Happy Doomsday, Renfro.
Happy Doomsday, Lauren. How's it going?
You know, it's a pretty good moment in time for me.
Yeah.
I think I'm doom scrolling less.
That's good.
So that helps. Yeah. I've been making tasty dishes.
Ooh, like what?
Yeah. I've been like, so, you know, one of the most popular genres of social media content is food. I've saved hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of recipes over the course of my social media career.
Yeah.
And I finally just started making some shit.
Yeah. I think most people just bookmark TikToks and never actually make any of them, right?
Yeah. Because it's like, man, that looks really good. I want that one day. And I finally started making some shit. I've been making bread. I think I told you that. Different types of bread, too. It's like, it's going really well. I'm moving on to English muffins next week.
Ooh.
Crazy. Crazy.
That's fancy.
Moving on to English muffins, I did this like salmon dish that had like creamy orzo involved, spinach, very good. Did this pastina, which is like an Italian penicillin soup, they call it.
Penicillin soup.
I don't know. I just wanted something warm and relaxing.
Penicillin soup sounds like what RFK Jr. would refer to some pharmaceutical company. Is that big penicillin soup they're putting in your body?
You know what? You're right.
Well, that was such not an impression of his voice. It's like a penicillin soup you put in your body.
It sounds like it hurts.
I know.
It sounds like it hurts to speak.
I know. It's too bad. Did you know it's, I saw an interview with his sister and she kind of does that too.
Oh.
So it's like a genetic thing. Yeah.
I thought something happened, like something was ruptured.
Hers is turned down to about half what his is, but she kind of does it too. So.
Interesting. So it's more of a condition than a something happened to him.
Yeah, though weirdly, I saw some interview where he said he thinks it's because of the time he ate the part of the dead bear or whatever.
What?
Well, what was the animal he left in Central Park?
Wasn't it a bear cub? I think it was a bear cub.
Yeah, or did he eat some of it or did he just touch it? Maybe he just touched it. Or that's how he thought he got the brain worm. That's what it is, not the voice. Okay, I'm mixing up my weird facts. That's how he thought he got his brain worm, not his voice. He didn't say that.
The thing that's most alarming and laughable, because you have to laugh to keep from crying, about that entire series of thoughts you just had is that those thoughts exist somewhere in reality about a person who's the head of Department of Health.
Yeah, it'd be funny if it was funnier.
Yeah, like nothing that you said is a lie. It's just not placed. It's just not placed in the right sequence of understanding. But he has brain worms.
He has brain worms. And he probably talks to them at night and they probably tell him. They probably whisper a little sweet nothings into his ear.
And he did do something with the dead animal. Either he touched it or he ate it. We don't know.
Yeah. Oh, well, a bunch of things. There's the whale story also.
Yeah.
You know, he just loves those dead animals.
Department of Health. Another relative of his came out to say, like, he's an awful person. Please don't confirm him. It amounted to absolutely nothing. But yeah. It was really interesting to hear her say, this is a terrible human.
Yeah, I don't know what the demographic of person is who would hear that and then be like, oh, I've changed my mind.
Because if your mind wasn't already set that he is not the right person for this, there was no changing it.
No, I think there's zero
also,
people who are swayable.
What do the family gatherings look like now that she did that?
I mean,
hey, Rob.
The family gatherings in the Kennedy family have probably always been strange.
True.
And dangerous, the curse of the Kennedys. You never know when one of them's going to be in some kind of freak accident or assassination.
That's very true.
You ever look at the curse of the Kennedys page on Wikipedia?
I didn't even know there was a Wikipedia page about this.
Yeah, there's so much misfortune in that family. There's a whole Wikipedia page just about the phenomenon.
Well, I know what I'm reading tonight.
Yeah, maybe it'd be a fun episode.
Maybe the finale.
Yeah.
Anyway, any doom going on with you?
Oh, not too much. Yesterday I had a really busy day. Yesterday I played tennis with a friend. Which I think I got to give up. I don't think I'm made for tennis. But I did.
Is it because of your ankle?
Well, that yesterday was the first time I tried it again post-ankle issue. Listener-wise, we've talked off-camera. Listener-wise, many episodes ago, I talked about hurting my ankle playing tennis. Then it hurt for a really long time to the point that I finally said, okay, I'll go to urgent care. After like a month and a half, I was very stubborn. Got an x-ray, and they said that it was just a heel spur, that I have a heel spur I didn't know about. And I was just not wearing particularly cushiony shoes. It's never affected me before. It's something you would have your whole life. But I could like barely walk for a week after the first time we played just because that flared up so bad. So it's something I have in common with Donald Trump. So it's nice to be able to see him eye to eye on.
Yeah, yeah. You have something you can relate on. Maybe you can get in his head, move some things in the right direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I got some super cushy shoes. Which is this brand called Kuru.
Uh-huh.
And uh-huh. Last plane out of Vietnam, they came over from Canada the same day I read about some new tariffs. Even got an email about the tariffs from the company. I was like, whoo. So I got them. They're great. They're really cushy. It did work. My ankles are fine today. But I don't see myself getting better at tennis to the point that we were playing like real competitive games. I just don't see it happening. It's embarrassing to play around other people that know what they're doing. I think I'm going to give up on tennis.
So it's your ego that's making you give up on tennis is what you're saying.
No, I mean,
do you have to be good at it?
I want to cross the line between just hitting the ball around to playing an actual game, but I also don't think that I'm willing to put in the time and effort to learn technique and actually get there. So I think it's just better not to. I think I'm done.
You got to wrap it up.
I don't know. I wasn't made for sports. Not new information to me.
So let's get into it. Last week we talked, or we walked through the American history of journalism and the steady, sad decline into, of course, corporate / billionaire ownership.
Mm-hmm.
This week, because the first one was part one, this week I want to talk specifically about the two catalysts that led to that decline, which are the 24-hour news cycle and the internet. Dun, dun, dun.
Bad. Bad internet.
I'm glad you started there because the first place I want to go is to hear your thoughts about the internet. Go.
As a whole?
As a whole.
Oh my gosh. You just want all my thoughts about the information highway? That is the.
I want every thought you've ever had.
Oh my God. You know what I love is the Bo Burnham song, Welcome to the Internet. Did you watch a special Inside?
Welcome to the Internet.
No.
Oh my God. I loved it.
Sorry.
I watched it like 10 times.
Sorry to let you down.
You know, in the 90s, it seemed like, wow, all this information at our fingertips. In chat rooms, we can talk about our interests. But, things devolved as they optimized, and now it's a hellscape that's replacing people's IRL reality with an online presence that's taking precedent over the way they think and interact.
Okay.
It's contorted our politics, our way of relating to one another, and we should go back to the Stone Age. Not really, but...
I like where you're at. I asked that question because I wanted to see where we were meeting each other in this conversation. I fully agree. Internet, bad. Intention of internet, good.
Yeah. started pleasantly, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes you don't know what you got and you got until it has taken over like the blob.
Yep. Yep.
Although that's not the premise of the blob, but you get my point. In short, the internet is the devil. That's my boomer take. That's my boomer take. And you cannot change my mind. All right, let's get into specifically the 24-hour news cycle. You know who we have to blame for that, right?
CNN.
CNN! Mm-hmm. On June 1st, 1980, Ted Turner started the cable news network.
This news service will be called the Cable News Network and will program continually updated half-hour segments of national news, business news, sports and features 24 hours a day.
And he went ahead with this model of 24-hour news and changed the game forever. Thanks, Ted. another billionaire deciding to do something that really doesn't need to be done.
Thanks, Ted.
Thanks, Ted. It was met with a lot of skepticism initially, but in 1991, during the Gulf War, we had the first time you had real-time coverage of such an intense event, and everybody was tuned in because we'd never seen anything like it. So they were tuned in like it was entertainment, and it solidified the popularity of it. So, of course, from that, you had the onset of other cable news networks like Fox News, MSNBC. So once again, Ted is to blame for the 24-hour news cycle. We talked last episode about how the decline came to be. This was the first step in a huge way. While the internet was in tandem, like, you know, it was moving as well. The early days of the internet weren't really looked at as a trustworthy place to get your news. It was, like you said, chat rooms. Things that you're like, oh, what is this? We're exploring this thing. And things were still on disks for how to get the internet. Like, this wasn't viable yet for news, for trusting news on this new, you know, information access machine. The precursor, I think, is the 24-hour news cycle.
For sure.
Which, yeah. What do you think is going through the mind of some billionaire who's like, we should do news, we should do it for 24 hours? Like, do you think there was the foresight that it would become this global shift in whether or not we should hear all this news and how the news would be created? Do you think that there was any of that foresight?
Maybe. I mean, obviously you had to have seen the potential and the commodification of it to want to do it at all. It seems like the slippery slope from there is almost, I think, would be even obvious to you then, right?
Yeah.
That things are turning into entertainment is sort of a obvious byproduct. Yeah, I don't know. I think kind of. Don't you think that it's kind of like the trajectory it went is almost like the inevitability of having 24-hour news? Like, most of the pitfalls seem so apparent to me.
Yeah, I mean, I struggle with like whether or not it was inevitable that 24-hour news cycle would occur. I don't know. That's a good question, because it's not inevitable until we have it, until you see it. Then it's like, oh yeah, this feels like it would have happened no matter what.
I didn't mean it's inevitable that the 24 news hour would be created. Man, it's inevitable how our news would devolve once we had it.
Oh, yeah. That for sure.
Yeah.
But I think when you hit the nail on the head in that, I don't think he had the foresight for that much. I don't think he even cared about that much. I think it was about the commodification. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, oh, I can sell ads 24 hours a day.
Right.
Somebody in the world's going to be watching it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, somebody in the world is going to be watching it, and I can.
But you have to know that in order to support that, you need more content, and more content could mean more news, or it could mean stretching what you consider news so that you can fill runtime.
Yeah. And I think in the beginning, if I'm thinking about CNN, even when we were kids, like, I think in the beginning, they did dig into more global stories, more in depth, where you had all these different correspondents in from different places. They did collaborations with BBC and all these other groups. And they still do these things, but not at the same level as they once did. Because at that time, and we'll get into this later, we talked about it even last episode. At the time, journalists were well-respected people in their professions. So you really only could go to trusted news sources to come up with 24-hour news. But more than that, it didn't always have to be breaking news. It didn't always have to be, it didn't always have to be breaking news. It could be the evergreen stories. And we had a lot more of that back then than we do now.
That's probably true, yeah.
Those kind of evergreen stories of holidays and different cultural things. And I see a lot less of that in today's CNN than we had back then.
Yeah, or more just random, like, what would you call it? Like, interest pieces.
Exactly. Like, underrepresented stories and things like that. That, like we said last episode, the local journalists used to take on.
Yeah.
But you would see that at a global level with CNN, where they would go into Yemen and talk about the culture in Yemen, or, you know, the breadbasket of the nation in the Middle East. Like, how is the breadbasket faring in this current climate? And then they tie it back to some political something. So we had way more of those kinds of interest pieces back then than we do now. I think now we do still have them, but they're not as publicized, and they tend to be behind a paywall, or they tend to be licensed to another outlet that you'd have to have access to the outlet in order to access it. So yeah, thanks, Ted.
Thanks, Ted.
Thanks, Ted. Okay, then the 2000s came. So that was mostly the 90s. Then the 2000s came, and seemingly overnight, the 24-hour news cycle was expanded beyond, well beyond television in a way that I think we're still trying to catch up to. Do you think we think about that? I feel like we're still trying to catch up to that.
In the 2000s?
Yeah, like that the news itself was now moving so fast that I think we're still trying to catch up with that. Like, we don't know how to keep up with the pace of the internet and the pace at which good news needs to be reported.
Yeah, I guess, are you saying just like it was, it's just too hard to filter out what deserves our attention? Or what do you mean?
It's not necessarily, not, I'm not speaking for the audience specifically. I'm speaking for the journalists, right? Mm-hmm. At this point, we'll talk about the audience, but the speed at which the internet connects us all in seconds, like you're saying, the chat rooms, you could be chatting with somebody in Arkansas and you live in Florida like that. You could chat with somebody in Europe like that. The pace at which the seconds that it takes to get news from one place to the next place shrunk overnight, it seemed like. And I think the time it takes to tell stories and to investigate stories and to really fact check stories diminish in a way that we still have not figured out how to catch up with.
Yeah.
From if you're the journalist making the content, I think we're still catching up. Or we're still trying to figure out how to catch up. And I don't know that we can.
Yeah. 24-hour news on TV was already like a just a ever hungry beast that kept needing to be fed to fill the hours. But then the internet's limitless. You don't have to 24 hours to fill. You just have as much, the more the better, I guess.
It's like 3D chess, right? Like, you have regular chess and that's broadcast. And then all of a sudden you make 3D chess and you're like, holy crap. Not only do we have to have more, we have to make sure that it's touching all these different parts of the globe, and it has to be endless.
In a perfect world, it's a positive thing because it's a lot more detailed and nuanced. You can, if you're just watching the news back in the day, you had to wait for a story to hit and then see it being talked about in real time.
Yeah.
Now you can move through things at your own speed, and you can go to CNN World News or CNN Domestic News as separate parts of the site. In a perfect internet, it's actually a positive change, right? It's just gangly in practice, I think.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this, whether or not it's actually a positive change. I think there's a lot of things on paper that are positive shifts and positive changes in society, and in this case with journalism. But in practice, it almost never is. It's like when you write it down and we're coming up with how this works, it's like, yes, this sounds good. But human behavior is both so unpredictable and somewhat predictable that it's never going to play out the way you guys have designed it to play out, or any given person has designed it to play out, because we're just too unpredictable in that way. We're predictably unpredictable, you know? And when I think of like good changes, or in theory it being good, we'd have to assume that people are going to act in good faith more often than not. And that the driving force behind the stories is in good faith. Not just the reader, but the content creator.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's hurt the quality of things more than the quantity that needs to be filled is just the way that interactions work on the internet. It's like headlines that are designed to make you clickbait headlines. And even the way that articles are structured, I get so frustrated trying to read articles on CNN. If you ever try to just read a whole article, it's always like the first paragraph kind of sums it up and the second paragraph starts getting into it, and then it like repeats itself. I feel like it just keeps like repeating itself over and over because it's almost like designed for someone who's skimming it or to try to keep you there longer. It's never just like a good beginning, middle, and end structure on an article. It's always like weird and repetitious. And
yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. And we're about to get into that.
Okay.
Needless to say, I think that with the advent of the internet, the news cycle became an absolute runaway train. It is still a runaway train. It's not something, I don't know that we'll ever get ahead of it again. I think it's out of the bag. We're just chasing it at this point to try to figure out what to do. So let's talk about the impact. last episode, I talked about who can call themselves journalists. With the advent of the internet and even the 24-hour news cycle, it completely changed the concept of journalism just generally. And then who could call themselves, who could claim to be one, rather. I gave the list of the kinds of journalists that we are now recognizing, one of them being bloggers and influencers, which I do not subscribe to the concept that those people are journalists. And that is probably not that's probably a controversial statement in today's climate or in this world that we're in now. But I think it's that redefinition of journalist that is a part of this internet landscape that is causing a huge problem in how we receive information and what is a credible source of that information. Because I think about once upon a time, Wikipedia was not considered an accurate source. It was not considered something that you could go to and use to cite in your papers or anything like that. Did you go through that same process?
Oh, yeah. With Growing Wikipedia? Up, I was told you got to use books or like .gov websites for your papers. You can't use Wikipedia. Of course, the people that grew up telling us that now believe that Democrats drink baby blood because they saw it on, you know, DemocratSatan.biz or whatever.
Democrat Satan. But even in that misguided understanding, and that mostly being because it was unknown at that time, and to be fair, Wikipedia is still person updated, just like the encyclopedias and stuff are.
Yeah.
That standard of what we should consider credible is almost entirely gone now. Mm-hmm. So there is some merit to that idea that those boomers or whoever the people were who were telling us you can't use these things, there's some merit to that because we've completely lost it and the pendulum has swung way too far in the other direction.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Keeping on with the impact, we talked about ethical codes last episode as well. And I don't think I need to go back through what the ethical codes are, but there's like 8 of them. And there are 4 or 5 entities, like journalism entities, that have established what these ethical codes are. And those are the codes by which individual journalists are meant to function by. That has all but gone out the window if you're now deciding that bloggers and influencers or any other citizen journalist, like we talked about last episode, is allowed to just claim that this is journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you mentioned earlier about clickbait journalism. That's usually the place where everyone goes when we talk about what has the internet done to journalism.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, is clickbait journalism. But we only get there once we've already decided anybody can be a journalist, mm-hmm. and that there's no real ethical codes to this. Now it becomes entertainment. Now it's about chasing revenue. Because again, we talked last episode, most of our main outlets are corporations. They're billionaire owned, billionaire destroyed.
Yeah.
And so they're chasing revenue. They are not looking at investigative journalism. They're chasing the revenue, which means they're chasing sensational headlines and stories that drive high traffic.
So I think even good journalism gets looped into that. Like even if you have a good investigative journalistic piece, once it gets brought to who's going to put it on the site, they're going to want a clickbait headline. They're going to want some sort of attention-grabbing image to go along with it. It's still going to get filtered through how can we get as much revenue out of this as possible, even if it's like Pulitzer-worthy reporting. It's just the entire infrastructure.
100%. And that is why there's so much mistrust or distrust in the media, because now all of it is sounding sensationalized. So what is real? What do we believe?
It's just a big penicillin soup, you know? It's just all mixed together.
Beautiful callback. Beautiful.
It's just a big penicillin soup.
I mean, I feel like the biggest threat is not so much, well, there's a lot of big threats, but one of the biggest threats is not even just the sensational, not just the shallow coverage that you get on different stories, because again, we talked about the change in the financial structure or the business model of journalism having to change entirely because of the internet. But the shallow coverage means that everything has to be digestible and you're ditching important issues. But more than that, exactly what you said, now the real stuff has to mimic that other stuff to where there's no discernible difference. You have to question it now.
Yeah.
Which brings me to one of the worst things that the current president has brought to our nation in the way that he has. Fake news.
Mm-hmm.
No one can discern between fake news and the real deal. And a huge part of that, no surprise, is the billionaires and corporations, conglomerates owning these outlets, competing for clicks and traffic and algorithm-based information, and then no one being able to discern the difference between hard-hitting stuff with real journalists, with real investigation, and stuff that's just based on nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Just based on making you feel whatever emotion.
Yeah, right, because it all looks like the same object. It has all the same hallmarks of sensationalism. It all blends together and it's harder to differentiate.
Yeah.
And of course, the subtext of Trump's using the term fake news is really you choose what news you want to be real.
Yeah.
It's all such a soup anyways that why don't you just choose your own subjective reality? It makes an environment where that's doable.
And the internet's the perfect highway for that.
Mm-hmm.
At least in America, almost entirely unregulated and under-researched and fact-checked topics are just eaten up by an algorithm where a lot of people are clicking on that thing because it's clickbait, it's sensational. It's like, oh, what's this thing? So a bunch of people click on it. And so it just keeps feeding people that same thing, or feeding that person, feeding that region, feeding that town, whatever that looks like. It just keeps feeding the same thing to them. So that choice, that concept of choice, you choose what news you want to see, is not really a choice at that point.
Yeah. It gives you an incorrect reflection of what the ecosystem is because things are being targeted to you. So especially if you're someone who's not particularly media literate and you don't understand the algorithms, you might go to Facebook and see it's suggesting 10, you know, alt-right leaning conspiracy theorist pages. And then your head, that's what Facebook looks like.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look like that for other people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this has been talked a million times over, the way that we go onto our own rabbit holes. But actually, I was thinking about this recently, that I think millennials are probably the most media literate generation in terms of the internet because we came up with it. And like we were being told not to cite Wikipedia and stuff on our papers growing up. That's a form of media literacy that boomers didn't have. They were just skeptical in a general way, where we were taught that in school as a way to engage with online media. And I think the younger generation takes it for granted. And they probably know to be skeptical of it, but weren't like taught that as a value. So I think we're sandwiched between generations that aren't particularly media literate with the internet.
That's interesting. Do you think they know to be skeptical? Because I'm finding like the younger generation following what they see on social media fairly blindly, without question. They believe it's real.
I mean, I feel like they should. I don't know. I don't have enough Gen Z people in my life to be more than a guess, you know?
I'm not gonna
like, I know really about Gen Z. We need to get a teacher on the podcast who's engaging with these younger generations.
Well, you know, the teachers are saying the kids can't read.
You're saying the kids can't read and they're all addicted to
their phones. The newer college students, the newer college students aren't meeting certain levels that they once met.
Yeah. That's diving into another topic we might cover.
Entirely different topic. Yeah.
I think media literacy is definitely an umbrella over this whole conversation because it's not just that all of this is a soup. Different people in different generations have a better skepticism towards it than others.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. I agree with that. I do agree with that. And we'll actually talk about that when I get into the is there hope section.
I like how you went like, we already know the answer. No spoilers. Yeah. I'm going to ask later if there's hope, but no spoilers. Don't worry. I won't spoil it for you.
Yeah.
We're just saying last episode, M. Night Shyamalan's not involved with this show. Nary a twist ending on the Happy Doomsday Pod.
Nope. It's always the same. We're very reliable in that way.
Yeah.
It's happy and it's doom. You mentioned the echo chambers, actually. Didn't you say something about echo chambers?
Yeah. Well, I think I was talking about our rabbit holes that we go down, but that's adjacent for sure.
Yeah. So I was thinking about that a lot when I was going through how has the internet impacted journalism and why it has bastardized the whole thing. And I think the consolidation that we talked about last episode, the consolidation of news, the outlets, of course, going to be the snowball, the beginning snowball that would create echo chambers.
Mm-hmm.
Because they get to decide, the conglomerates get to decide, or need to decide, rather, based on capitalism. And they have to make a certain amount of money. And so they create these algorithms, just like we talked about, and they target areas where that thing is popular.
Yeah.
And it has no choice but to echo, even if the person doesn't necessarily believe that, it ends up just reinforcing what a person has already been exposed to. Mm-hmm. So like you said, that's what you said. You were talking about that. You think that's what Facebook is, because mm-hmm. the people in your region tend to click on this thing a lot, and it keeps feeding you that because you are among the number of people who fall within that region.
Mm-hmm.
So the internet has created a huge echo chamber. And much as we are connected, and I think this is a common criticism of the internet and social media generally, like we're the most connected and yet the most disconnected we've ever been.
Yeah. I think also, this was just occurring to me, to think of like the most innocuous version of this possible. Think about how, maybe people don't even know this, on Netflix, you know, when you're scrolling through, it doesn't show you the actual movie poster. It shows you like a main character and the title.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a movie, weirdly, it's like almost never the one sheet. It's always
And
the reason is because it shows different things to different people.
Yeah.
So on your Netflix, you see a character that's going to somehow algorithmically more appeal to you clicking it than if I see it. And what's super weird to think about, and again, this is like a more innocuous example, but I think it's a reflection of the fact that even the things we're taking for granted, we are being shown a different version of the internet.
Yeah.
Even something as innocuous as the thumbnail on a movie, we're seeing two different things. And I think that there's a lot of people that don't understand how just the extreme extent to which now our internet experiences are tailored to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you talk to someone who's like a super Trumper, they're literally living in a different reality in a way that's not a hyperbole. It's the media that they're being shown and the opinions they're being shown are so prevalent that they think that is a bigger reality than it is, or it's a more represented opinion than it really is.
Yeah.
We used to at least have a shared internet. We all got on CNN.com and we all saw the same homepage.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how the internet works anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because I wasn't thinking about that as I was going through this episode concept. And I didn't know that about Netflix. It makes sense. I knew insofar as when I go to my Netflix in a certain area, I don't see the same stuff. And some of the content's not even available to me, depending on where I am.
Mm, yeah.
So I understood it that way, but I didn't go so far as to think about the thumbnail. But that it does. Oops. Why wouldn't it go that far? But you're right. And I think it's on both sides of the coin. I think part of the shock of liberals is they are on a completely different side of the internet as well. They're on a completely just different side of news as well. And so the uprising of a lot of alt-right ideology has been a shock, because they're like, where are these people? So I think on both sides, it's like you're in your own echo chamber. I do think by and large, the left is more than the right. I think that there's a smaller group than we think that believes to nuts and bolts what is happening on the right. And maybe that's just me being hopelessly optimistic. But I think the difference is on the right, they believe it to the core and don't have any tolerance for the idea that there's another world. I think I see a lot more libs saying things like, oh, this is why they're being fed X, Y, and Z. And they don't have that same level examination on their end. They don't ever question. They're just like, no, they're just insane. They're crazy. They want all of this. And it's talking points that they get thrown at you versus the left that's like, how did they get here? What is this thinking? Let me go investigate the types of things they're being fed. And then they realize, oh, it's because you've been fed all of these things.
Absolutely. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's something we've said before, but the big difference is a lack of curiosity.
Like
me, I want to understand those people. I have Truth Social on my phone. It's probably giving me a virus. Yeah. It's probably why I get my credit card stolen. But I have it on my phone. I see what they see. And I go, oh, that's what's happening over there. And even then, even trying to get into those spaces and see what they're seeing, still stuff takes me off guard. When Trump was talking about they're eating cats and dogs, I was like, where the fuck did that come from?
Yeah, yeah.
You learned that that was going around just that week. I mean, that was a recent thing. But I'm not going to name anybody on the podcast, but I do know of a person in my life who believes that. So it's a real thing that was spreading around. And even me, as someone who loves learning about QAnon weirdos and all that stuff, actively searching for that, had no idea that was opinion going around. It's like impossible. Also, their news cycle moves at 100 miles an hour. All those guys tweet 1,000 times a day.
Yeah.
Theirs is harder to keep up with than ours. But
I think theirs is harder to keep up than ours because it's more erratic. And I think it moves faster, but it is very repetitive at the same time.
And everything's disposable, too. They'll be like, next week, a crazy thing's going to be released. Hell's going to break loose. Next week comes and nothing happens. They don't give a shit. They just move on to the next thing.
Yeah, yeah. What's the Steve Bannon thing everybody keeps citing where it's just like what is it? Overwhelm the something?
Like overloading the system with just like too much news to filter. This is kind of
I think that is very simply the right way of getting information to their people. They overwhelm it so much where they're not going to investigate beyond this point. These are the talking points. That's what I'm going with. I had a coworker yesterday. We went for a walk and they were in Florida. No, Oahu. Because she's pregnant. They were doing like their last trip before she has the baby. And she's talking to this one couple. One of them was from Georgia. The other was from Florida. And I'm just waiting for her to tell me some Trump story because these are two places where very clearly there will be Trumpers involved.
Yeah.
Long story short, they were talking. They asked her, like, how are you guys? One of the couples asked them, how are you guys handling the tariffs? Yada, yada. They talk about that. Later, after the hula dance and all that stuff was done, one of the women from Florida came up to her and said, I'm so sorry. Can you help me understand the whole tariff thing? Because I just don't understand. I'm not really about voting or anything, but I'm just very curious. And both of us at the same time, when she was telling me this story, I was like, she 100% voted for Trump. And she's only now starting to get curious about the fact that a Canadian girl came to her and talked and mentioned tariffs.
Yeah. Still none of know what tariffs are.
Yeah. Still doesn't.
Yeah.
And that was just a couple weeks ago. But the only then did the curiosity come. It took. She's Chinese. It took a Chinese woman from Canada to talk about tariffs for her to go, huh? Can you explain to me? And then not even enough. I find it interesting that she wanted her to explain it to her and do that labor for her without her actually.
You can go to google.com. What is a tariff? That would give you your answer.
And so she explained it to her and so did her husband, who's from Seattle. And the woman is like, oh, you know, not about voting for anyone. It's like she 100% voted for Trump and is now like, oh, I think I did something wrong here. it's crazy.
It's
That lack of curiosity is very fascinating. And also what we've talked about the lack of creativity. When there's no curiosity, I don't think there's any creativity.
Yeah.
But that's another topic, perhaps for another podcast episode.
But you know what runs counter to that is how great their movies are. Did you see God's Not Dead Part 5?
No. Part 5?
One day I'm going to watch all 5 and do a special episode. I haven't seen any.
Please, please do, because I probably will never watch them. We talked about echo chambers. It's obvious that it's information overload. People can't sift through anything. But I will say, and I'm ending on this good note about the impact. There is a good impact of the internet. It has brought us podcasts.
That's true. There's plenty of good stuff on the internet. You know? There's funny videos of cats. There's recipes you can make stuff like you're doing. Probably some other stuff.
You want to know one really fun one?
What?
So I'm trying to get more active again without like paying for memberships. I went to YouTube, looked up Tybo. And let me tell
Tybo.
You.
Tybo! Whoa! You threw me back.
Throwback.
Whoa.
And let me tell you, it is a workout.
Tybo's still good,
man. Yes, wow. It's still good.
Wow.
It's still good. This one lady is like just kicking her leg constantly. She's like not even letting her leg down. She's just, I'm like, how is she doing that?
They were built different in 90s aerobics videos.
Yeah, they really were. I was sweating harder than I've ever sweat in a...
Wow.
Yeah.
We should bring back Typo.
Bring back... Well, no.
Why do we even make new exercise videos? They've all been done already. We can just do the ones that have already been made.
No, everyone says that there's new ways of exercising.
There's not. Move real fast and you'll sweat.
This time, you'll do it. You move real fast in the heat. That's what they did to hot yoga.
Yeah.
Except you're not really moving fast. They'll change one thing.
They'll update the royalty-free music that they're dancing to.
Yeah. You know?
I did actually, you know, I've gotten into VHS in this last year. Mm-hmm. And I've
very anti-internet of you. Wow.
I'm going back, going analog. And I did, for real, work out to a Richard Simmons VHS tape that I got.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, how was it?
Oh, it was great. It's very fun. He's so fun.
He is fun. He was a lot of fun. R.I.P.
Well, definitely archival preservation of media is one of the biggest great things about the internet. You ever watch a movie where they have to like go to the library and find an old article on microfiche and they look at the little thing?
Microfiche. Have you ever dealt with microfiche?
I never actually have, and does look fun.
I have.
So I will say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I never have. I'm going to go to the local library soon and tell them I'm solving a cold case or something and ask for an old newspaper on microfiche just so I can use one.
We're talking about information overloads, and then we talked about the good things that come from the internet. We just went over that, and now I want to ask, is there hope?
Oh, now we're asking.
Is there hope for
the internet?
Is there hope that journalism can be restored to a respectable field that people can trust again? How do we get there? Do we think that it's Pandora's box is out and we're never going to get back to a place where people can trust the media?
I don't know. Because I think there's a lot of separate things that need to be worked out. One, new media revenue model needs to be better worked out. That's still just not quite worked out.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what I meant by saying that we are chasing it. Like, I don't know that we're going to catch up to it.
Yeah, we still haven't figured out how to monetize it correctly.
Yeah.
And the information era. And two, we need media literacy. We need people to be skeptical and curious and objective, and they are not at the moment. I don't know if there's a whole lot of hope. I think it's totally possible, but it is going to take something big. It's going to take a real movement of a real like new wave of people rethinking our relationship with the internet. It would take something pretty massive, I think, for us to be like, journalism's back.
Internet 3.0.
Oh my God. Are you going to get on some kind of Bitcoin thing right now?
Blockchain.
Oh my God. You're still talking about the blockchain.
That's got to be an episode. Blockchain is the new internet.
Okay. You'll have to convince me.
You have to come in open-minded.
Gotta come in open-minded.
All right. Do I think there's hope? Not really. But what's new? You know? No. I fully agree that media literacy is a huge part. So much so that I asked ChatGPT,
is there hope?
Yeah.
What did it say?
You know what they said?
Dying to know, actually.
It said, this is how media literacy can be improved. Education and curriculum integration.
Do they sell computer classes in schools?
I was just about to say that. When we were kids, we had computer classes that were mandatory. You had to learn how to type and all that stuff. You had to learn how to use the computer just generally and what you should be looking at, what sites you shouldn't look at, the whole nine. They no longer do that.
And I think a lot of kids don't even touch a desktop, you know?
Honestly, a lot of kids don't know how to type at all.
Yeah, which is good. Yeah, I took a typing class.
It's like boomers all over again. They're just like this.
Yeah.
We're the only ones doing the whole QWERTY situation.
And when we were bored as kids, what we do? We clicked around in the random system files. We punched in numbers on the calculator. You just went around. I remember on my own as a kid, I changed all the sounds on my PC. So like when it started up, it played a quote from Dumb and Dumber instead of the Windows noise. And that was just purely from clicking around and being like, oh, what does this do? What does this do? What does this do?
Yeah.
Kids now, it's just like a magic box. Mm-hmm. They have no concept of how the the computer works anymore than boomers do.
Yeah, and how you get it to do the different things that you want it to do. You can hardly get the kids today to Google anything. Like, they're not even, they want you to tell them the answer. They're not going to do the work to find it themselves.
Yeah. And even then, I remember I had a computer class where I learned how to use Google.
Yes.
In like middle school, we're like, even as simple as like put quotations around the thing you want, verbatim, a minus sign for things you want excluded. I don't think kids know that today. Do they?
They don't. They don't. I still use all of those search features in almost everything. I use it in Gmail. I use it anytime I'm searching anything, and it's all built around that idea of how this is how you search for things. Yeah. And kids don't have that anymore. They just don't.
It's crazy because it's even more important than it was when we were kids.
Yes. Like, what is it when you're trying to search for exactly something? How do you search for that thing?
Yeah.
And they're like, they have no clue. And I don't understand the concept of taking that away from school when, you know, they've been telling us forever that this was the future, that this, you're going to need to know these things. Though, why are you not preparing them then? If this is going to be more part of their lives than it was for millennials.
Sure. It's weird. It's like for us, we were preparing for this new era that it set in. Now the era is here and they stop learning it.
Yeah. It makes no sense.
I do think, though, ChatGPT is right. That's where it starts.
Where it starts.
It's in the schools.
I will say that ChatGPT has not said they have hope, just that it can be improved, but it will be a large undertaking.
Yeah.
So ChatGPT is very realistic.
Yeah.
Promoting critical thinking.
Yeah, but that's a little open-ended.
Yeah, it is.
I agree, but that's also in the schools. That's also in the schools.
That's in the schools. But ChatGPT says specifically, from a young age to adulthood, you need to know how to think and question information instead of passively accepting it to combat the spread of misinformation. Mm-hmm. I agree, Chat.
And I also agree that you can only teach it in that age range. You teach people that in an older generation, they're like, oh, I know, I do my own research. And you're like, that's not what I meant. I mean, go out of your way to find stuff you like.
Yeah. This includes understanding how emotions are manipulated in media and recognizing fallacies or misleading techniques. I will say, beyond in journalism, when I was studying journalism in undergrad, we were taught beyond the average person's ability to recognize fallacies and misinformation. Because that was literally our role as journalists to make sure that we're always doing, because once again, code of ethics. Yeah. But the average person, that is tougher. Because I'm not sure, without going into, again, curriculum, how you teach them. Actually, that's not true, because you could teach them the same way. It starts out with seeing a headline and being shown like the difference between two headlines telling the same story. It starts there.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, they've always used emotions to manipulate the masses in media. It's some degree to pick up a paper and sell the paper. Mm-hmm. It's just that the content you received may not have reflected the same sensationalization or sensationalism as the headline, but you got good factual stuff in the actual article. Mm-hmm. Now we're just sensationalized all the way through.
Yeah. Even random people on Twitter, you know, that's monetized.
Yeah.
Even things that aren't news.
That's a whole other topic. Yeah, that's a whole other topic. It's so interesting to me that a singular tweet gets people paid.
It's crazy. It's so obviously bad. Yeah.
It's nuts. Okay, then they have encouraging media literacy in... What? You just said that, chat.
It's repeating itself.
It's repeating itself.
What are you, some kind of a robot?
I know. Boo. I think the way they're describing this one, it's repeating itself in the headline, but when I'm reading quickly, it's saying that it's essential to teach people about the mechanics of platforms, about algorithms and stuff like that. So I don't like how chat said that, but I do agree. If you're teaching them, like you're saying about the black box and like poking around and seeing what this thing does, teach them the mechanics and about how algorithms work so that maybe you can stop them from being in this echo chamber.
Yeah, I mean, there's a science component to learning about it, right? It's not just opinion and politics and writing. There is, like, they should learn that the ideas behind the hardware and the coding and the algorithms and the numbers that drive things. Demystify it.
Yeah. It's opening it up and realizing it's just a goddamn machine.
Mm-hmm.
And it has taken over my life. It's like when you see those like human interest pieces and they talk about how this one neighborhood or this one school decided to take away phones from the kids and what that did to the kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if they understood the mechanics, what does that do to their addiction to the use of it? I don't know if it changes anything, but I like to think that if you understand this is just a box with stuff in it, then maybe you'll have more control over it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also, they're so young. So I think no matter what, they're going to be susceptible. Chat goes on to say, improving trust in reliable sources, obviously. But I think that's hard in the consolidation that we currently find ourselves in because billionaires own it. So why should I trust the Washington Post at a certain point when I know Bezos is at the helm and he could decide at any point what gets published and when and how far they go into a given story? So yeah. I think in order to improve trust, you gotta eat the rich.
Eat the rich. I'm down for it. Yeah.
Okay. Empowering critical consumption of social media. That's the same thing.
ChatGPT, we're not paying for the premium service if you don't stop repeating yourself.
We're not paying for the premium service.
I was going to offer ChatGPT a third co-host spot, but not anymore.
Not anymore. And then I do like this one, community-based initiatives. I don't like, I do like community-based anything, but I don't like the idea that you and I have to take it upon ourselves to make sure everybody's educated on any given thing. Like, it's our labor to take on and not something that society is in the best interest of society as a whole.
Yeah.
But I suppose if you're the 1%, if you're a politician, then it is in your favor for all of these people to blindly follow what's going on. But it's very annoying that we're in this place where it's now on the citizens to create programs that will teach people media literacy. Because what makes the people in your region or in your area trust you to do that for them?
The underlying problem is still there for them to even trust you. I think ChatGPT had it with, it starts with schools and younger education at a younger age. I think after a certain age, you're so set in your ways that they're like, the underlying problem is rooted in and it's hard to redirect. You got to get these kids back on just computer literacy.
Computer literacy. CSS, we used to call it.
You remember those typing games where like you click the cue and it sends a missile or whatever?
That was literally your computer lab time. Your computer lab time was like, okay, we're all going to do typing drills. And the teacher was walking through the different desks.
Yeah.
To make sure everybody was doing their thing. And it would tell you, nope, you got that wrong. And then it would spin back around to make you do that exact one again.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Well, kids don't even have computer labs anymore, I don't think. So is there hope? I think everybody has to touch grass and we need to take everyone's phones. That's the only way we're going to get this done.
You should go back to telegraphs. Remember telegraphs?
Yeah. Remember Morse code?
Oh, yeah. Remember Morse code? We should go back to smoke signals. Remember smoke signals?
Yeah. Pigeons.
Remember that?
All these pigeons, you know, dependent on us. We made them so dependent. Put them to use.
Yeah. Remember the Pony Express?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know.
Remember an abacus? I didn't need a smartphone or the computer. I just used my abacus back when I was growing up.
You know, I even like the word abacus, actually. That's a good word.
It's fun. It sounds like something out of Harry Potter, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good word. It makes you feel smart.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, very fancy.
Mm-hmm.
Very fancy. Any final take?
No, I think this was good for solidifying to me the solution, actually, which is grade school education.
So, well, that was all ChatGPT. I didn't even come up with that.
So thank God we have this Department of Education, right? That can help us all to come together. That's not going anywhere, right? The Department of Education?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my final take is that the internet is evil.
Yeah.
That's my final take. And I did say at the start of the podcast, you will not change my mind. But it is more complex than it being evil. There's a lot of great things that come with the internet.
Yeah,
I think the problem is it was created with wonder and excitement and all these things, and no one thought, no one saw how big it can get and how wild it can get and all of these things, and all of this freedom is simply too much for the human brain. We're not evolving fast enough to accommodate the internet. So that's what I mean when I say the internet is evolved.
Yeah. I remember who was said this. I heard someone somewhere say one time that you can split the current psychology of the population between people who can handle vast amounts of information and those who can't, which I think is an interesting way of differentiating people. In the information era, some people just have no facilities for being able to navigate a world with constant flow of information.
Mm-hmm. I find that fascinating because I think about what the next evolution of man looks like. You know, we talk all the time about like, oh, we're descended from apes, and you go through that whole evolution chart. What does it look like now? I mean, we're already standing upright. We're already doing all these things. What does the next evolution look like with these new tools that we have when we don't need to use certain things? Or is there going to be some sort of node in our brains that aren't needed anymore? Is there going to be an organoids? Is there going to be an organ that is rendered pointless because
some part of our brain is just never active and it just slowly evolves away?
yeah. Whoa.
We're gonna be like the people just... that was a big concept.
I didn't like it, I gotta say.
Yeah, it was scary. It's like you took Idiocracy to like a really scary extra layer.
Yeah.
Actually de-evolving by not using our brains.
We go backwards.
And then we end up eventually back into a little amoeba. Lloyd. That's fun. Full circle.
Full circle. The chart is literally a pyramid.
Yeah. Ape up to person, back down to little thing in water. We get our tails back, and we crawl back in the water.
I just want to know, is it going to hurt? If it doesn't hurt, fine.
It'll happen slowly, so no, it'll be good.
Okay, all right. Because I do think I've seen people who have devolved.
There are Neanderthals amongst us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we actually believe that people are waking up? I don't.
No. Also, you know what? Actually, a major aspect I feel like we didn't talk about, this will be potentially a future episode. A lot of the internet is just fake now. Bots. Uh-huh. A lot of the comment sections are just bots. Posts are made by bots. There's potential that the internet becomes so overwhelmed with fake shit that it just becomes completely useless.
Internet 3.0!
But
you keep walking right into Internet 3.0.
Okay, I still barely know what that is, so I'll have to wait for that episode. But... okay. If the internet becomes so useless that even your average person is like, I can't even use this thing anymore, that might inadvertently push us back into traditional mediums. If it gets so bad that we have to throw it away and we go back to traditional mediums.
That would be amazing.
AI might usher that in.
That would be amazing.
So bad that it helps us.
Yeah.
Glimmer of hope.
Bring on the de-evolution. Bring on the de-evolution.
Yeah. That's very happy doomsday of us to have a glimmer of hope that's predicated on doom, you know?
Yeah. I can't wait to be an amoeba.
That will be fun. I love the water. Yeah.
Love the water. All right. Make sure you rate and subscribe to Happy Doomsday everywhere you get podcasts. Follow Happy Doomsday Pod on all socials except Twitter. And until next time, Happy Doomsday.
Happy Doomsday.